Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here, Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. Open that water, Casey.
Boom.
Yes.
There we do. We got it.
Casey's here, everybody.
Hey, everybody.
How's it going?
It's going great. Excited to talk about this movie. It's been slightly longer coming, I guess.
I know.
Yeah. A
couple of reschedges.
Yeah.
And, dude, I so look forward to these. I got to tell you.
Yeah, I do too.
You're not going to be like, off the hook anytime soon.
Yeah, it's like I stay fixated on whatever the next movie is for right. The entire duration between. So glad to get this one off my chest and move on.
Oh, Paths of Glory.
Yeah.
So, wow. First time I saw it.
Yeah. What you know, you told me yesterday, we didn't talk about it too much, but you said it wasn't what you expected.
Right.
So what, you know, that's interesting to me. What were your expectations and how was it different?
Well, I didn't know anything about the movie.
Yeah.
I knew it was a 1957 World War II.
Mm-hmm. World War One.
War One. Good Lord. Kubrick film starring Kirk Douglas. And that is all I knew. And then the cover shot of Kirk's face, basically.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just thought it was a straight up sort of war movie.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it was a total anti-war movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I didn't think about it. Of course it is.
Yeah.
It's Kubrick.
Right.
And I didn't know that it was kind of a few movies in one, like a courtroom drama.
Weirdly, a very modular kind of movie. Like each section, I think, is very well executed, but they are kind of distinctly, you know, laid out. And it's sort of like we're in the war movie, now we're in the courtroom drama, now we're in sort of like the, I don't even know what you call the last part, the kind of existential, philosophical, Bergman-esque kind of,
brutal.
You know. You can't change your fate sort of thing.
Yeah. And I didn't know that it was a tight 90 minutes.
Very tight, yeah. I mean, it really moves at like a good clip. There's very little, fat on the bone. It's just, it's all kind
of. I could have used a little more. I'm not knocking it because it was kind of a perfect film.
Yeah.
But like if it would have been 15 minutes longer
and
I would have gotten some more stuff, I wouldn't have been complaining it anyway.
Yeah. Not that it would have added 15 minutes to the screen time, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but the actor that's on the film, Timothy Carey, was a real handful, and he is fantastic, but he was also a real handful to work with.
Heard rumors.
He ended up getting fired off the picture, and that was why they didn't show the three soldiers that ultimately end up getting court-martialed and executed during the battle sequence. That was going to be a little bit more of a thing.
Oh, really?
Where you kind of see them acting very heroically during that, that sequence where they try to take the anthill, you're going to kind of check in on each one of them. And then that was going to make it even more
to really juxtapose
like,
their
enraging
injustice.
Later on when you saw what happened to them ultimately.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. You didn't need it really.
No, I don't think so either. I think that would have been like, there's one thing that this film does. I think that later Kubrick's film don't do so much. This one does maybe editorialize a little bit more than his later standard did.
Yeah.
Or at least in a kind of like this film, I think, plays it very straight and very kind of sincere. It feels almost like an angry film in a way.
Yeah.
Whereas I think later in his career, Kubrick might have still had that, but he kind of buried it underneath a little bit of irony or cynicism or kind of...
Well, and even humor in the case
of
Strangelove.
Yeah, exactly. The humor is really kind of missing at this point. There's like one or two moments, like when Timothy Carey kills the cockroach. He says, well, now you got the edge on him.
Yeah.
Because the guy's worried that the cockroach is going to outlive him.
God, that was a great
scene. The
night
scene. Before they're executed. And
what a line,
says,
man.
Boom, now you got the edge on him.
Tomorrow, I'm going to be dead and this cockroach is going to be alive.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck, dude.
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine just being in that situation?
Yeah, and the line, too. And we'll be jumping all over the place. Yeah. But in that same scene when the one guy broke down and said, I haven't had a sexual thought in 2 weeks or whatever.
Yeah.
That was such
since I heard this news.
Odd, very sad line.
Very visceral. Uh-huh. Very sort of like it really, really kind of brings it all home. Like, oh, yeah, that's what that would be like. That's what it is to be dead, you know?
Yeah, but I almost felt like he was taking a stab at humor there,
yeah.
Or was he?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a tough line to
just
read
awkward.
For me.
It's a weird scene because he's making small talk with that guy that he kind of knows, and he's like, you got anything, got a drink for us? He's like, yeah, I have some of this, hands him his flask.
Right.
And they're just trying to make small talk, but they both know what's going on. And then after just a moment, he says the line about, you know, hasn't had a sexual thought and just kind of breaks down, begs him to save him. He says, nobody can save you, man.
Yeah.
And then
there's a lot of that. Yeah. Like, dude, pull yourself together.
Exactly. Exactly.
And die wonderfully.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what the cowardly kind of general.
Oh, yeah. Moreau says that. They died wonderfully.
Your men died wonderfully. Yeah. Yeah.
God.
And right. It's like he's looking at him. He wants to get a rise out of Kirk Douglas at that moment.
Yeah.
You know, to just see if he's going to keep it together or not.
Yeah. Well, before Kirk Douglas even comes in there, before Dax is even in there, he's having a legitimate conversation about and he even says, like, sometimes, you know, they'll do something that really kind of takes the shine off the whole thing.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Brings the mood down too much. And today it was wonderful. It was great. It was perfect. It was like the best one I've been to.
Yeah. Jeez, brutal. So jumping back to the beginning, first of all, there's that first little bit of narration that just sort of very cleanly sets the table.
Yeah, only narration in the movie from kind of an unseen, unknown narrator, just a, you know, better than a text scroll, I suppose.
Yeah, but what it did was for me, and if you're not super acquainted with World War I and what trench warfare was like just the one line in there that stood out to me was success was measured by an advance of 100 yards.
Yeah, like, and deaths were measured in the tens of thousands to get that kind of yardage.
Yeah, and it was this war. And were you able to listen to the Friendly Fire episode?
I did. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so our colleagues over at Friendly Fire at Max Fun, you guys heard on the Platoon episode, John Roderick, Adam Pranica, and Ben Harrison did this movie a couple of months ago or whatever. And I saved it and listened to it. But and Roderick is just a true historian and war historian, so he really knows his shit. But he really kind of set the World War I thing up in such a way that, like, you know, trench warfare was brutal, and it was being fought on paper by generals in fancy rooms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With very little regard. Like, it's amazing how wars have changed over the years with as far as regard for loss of life.
Yes, absolutely. The scale of casualties that would just be kind of casually discussed and—
Like, well, we didn't try it.
Yeah.
Or we didn't win that one.
Yeah.
We lost, 5,000 men, so let's make another run.
Well, a lot of historians kind of credit World War I with kind of souring Europe, not necessarily on war, because they had World War II not long after, but it is this sort of, like, extremely traumatic event where just millions upon millions of people died from these smaller European countries, where a million people dying is like a significant part of the population as a whole.
Yeah.
And just this feeling that whereas war might have had a sheen to it before, it had some kind of glory attached to it, there was really nothing glorious whatsoever about the trench warfare, about living in just the mud and rats and disease and—
Well, the movie title is the only joke in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
And it's
there are no paths
even,
of glory.
Even that's, it's an abridgment of a line from a poem.
Right.
The paths of glory lead but to the grave.
Well, there you have it.
So, you know, but yes, the title is that kind of, the only hint of that Kubrick sarcasm, that kind of irony of, like, you know, there are no paths of glory here. There are no real paths, period.
No, it was
everybody's
paths
kind
of shit.
Everybody's kind of, like, predetermined to kind of play out their role. It's like a line from Full Metal Jacket, like, it's a giant shit sandwich and we're all going to have to take a big bite, you know?
Yeah, that might have to be next, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's—
I was sort of thinking about what to tackle next.
They are very interesting to kind of look at next to each other.
I think we should.
Yeah,
yeah. The other line from Moreau that stood out to me when they were talking about these forward positions and forward movements is that's their job is to soak up bullets and shrapnel.
Yeah, yeah.
To soak up bullets and shrapnel to allow the men behind them to advance.
That's right.
And it's literally like, all right, let's put up a human wall to just get thrashed and so we can get a little bit further.
I mean, it's like that battle in Barry Lyndon too, where you're marching in a straight line where it is like the people in the front row are just like, you are there to be the bullet catcher and
crazy.
Let the rest of us kind of get a little further than you did.
Although I will say, and we'll get to that fucking amazing battle scene.
Tracking shot.
Dax, like, he's up front, man.
He is, yeah. No, I mean, he's the first one over the hill and the first, you know, with a whistle and everything. I mean, he's leading the charge. So he's a stark contrast to the generals. And
that's why he didn't fit in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So that first scene in the, it's really the first scene in the film with the two generals, Moreau and who was the other one?
Let's see. There's Moreau and Brouillard, I think, are
yes.
the two.
Yeah. The blocking in that scene is so crazy.
It's like a dance, you know?
It's a total
dance. It's beautiful because it shows you that fluid movement of the camera.
Yeah.
That Kubrick took a lot from this German director who made a lot of great films, Max Ophüls.
Uh-huh.
Or Ophüls, I'm not sure how you pronounce the German, but he was known for kind of his trademark tracking shots, these really beautiful fluid camera movements where the camera is like dancing with the actor.
Uh-huh.
And just the way you stage, you know, a fluid master like that where maybe a character begins in a close-up and then walks to the background and
yeah.
suddenly you're in like a two-shot or a wide and then somebody else comes in from the, you know, all that kind of beautiful choreography that it's like editing in the camera because you're getting
yeah.
multiple setups, but it's all kind of flowing from one shot.
It was really interesting
yeah.
the way they were moving all over the place.
Yeah.
And even in the end, it's a technique I haven't seen before, I don't think. And, well, maybe occasionally, but that thing where the characters are leaving, walking further away from camera, and the audio goes with them, and you hear their voice trailing off.
It's like they're, yeah, I mean,
that's
it really,
like an
it feels
outdoor
like
thing
yeah.
usually. You don't see that
yeah.
done in a room.
Yeah,
very
I mean, it
often.
Feels like they're being like boomed from like behind the camera or something. So like as they
yeah.
move away, like
it's really interesting.
I mean, the camera can see up so high because he wants to show those high ceilings
right.
and all the
opulence,
ornate
sure.
art opulence. Yeah. So it's like that. There's nowhere for the boom to hide, really. And I mean, actually, it's surprising for Kubrick. You know, not that there was much he could have done about it, but in all those tracking shots and like the trenches, there's like a lot of boom shadow
so
happening there.
Oh, you sure?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, because it was released in what, 57?
It is a cheap movie, you know,
and
by
he made
by
it
standards.
In whatever, 55 or 56,
yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like he was trying to do stuff that people weren't doing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Those long shots. I mean, that was essentially, I wrote down here, it's a Steadicam shot before they had the Steadicam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It
yeah.
was a guy trying to hold the camera very
yeah.
still.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As he walked like all the way through that trench.
Yeah, yeah.
So effective.
And yeah, I mean, as far as the whole boom thing, like Kubrick is shooting like sync sound. So whereas like you know the
tell everyone what that is.
So I mean, they're recording the dialogue live at the time of
yeah.
shooting. So they're not just dubbing everything afterwards.
Right.
Like. You know, like a lot of filmmakers, especially the more kind of visually expressive ones, did for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention silent cinema, where of course there was no concept of recording the sound. But
right.
So yeah, I mean it is the level of complexity in kind of choreographing your shots when you have a moving camera, when you have you know outdoor lighting, uncontrollable lighting, or even a lot of interior lighting. Just having that boom.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's going to be adds a lot of complexity to pulling off a shot like that.
Yeah, I'm curious about, like, he was doing such different and innovative things. And this was early Kubrick,
mm-hmm.
so he hadn't earned that reputation yet of the auteur,
yeah.
like, don't question him.
Right, right, right.
So I imagine there were even crew members that were like, what is this guy doing?
Is this going to work? Yeah.
With this,
yeah.
like, why does he – that's not how you shoot a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't
exactly.
walk 200 feet
yeah.
down a trench and have
right.
people – carrying cables and like
yeah
now
yeah.
nowadays it's like very commonplace
standard, yeah,
but
yeah.
sure back then it was really innovative
yeah and I mean the quality of the sound in the film like it doesn't feel like a film or a film from that period so much like
right.
it has just like a more lively visceral kind of sound to it like you said with the way the voices echo around the rooms
uh-huh.
and it just doesn't have that like studio like perfected kind of quality to it
yeah. Yeah, and the sound is really effective. Like, I'm glad you brought that up because not only I guess you'd call it a score, which is really just a lot of drums.
Pretty much, yeah.
Which Kubrick does that. He locks in on stuff.
Yeah.
And just kind of hammers it home throughout a film a lot of times.
There's a lot like in Strangelove, too.
Yeah.
There's like the same kind of, you know, slightly ironic kind of military music that's playing.
Yeah, but it's super effective. It, like, there are two or three different times. The first thing that comes to mind is the bombardments.
Yeah.
It's just like it has a really
yes.
profound effect
yeah.
when you're watching the movie
yeah.
of just fucking anxiety.
The way the sound is almost distorted and
yeah,
it's just
it's
like
just constant.
It's unpleasant and loud and in your face and yeah.
So that the drum stuff all throughout the movie, but especially and we'll get to this later, but the long walk toward
yeah.
to the gallows
yes.
essentially.
Yeah.
that drum just like got to the point where I was just like, stop, make it stop.
Yeah.
And then the end, the very end in the bar with the German woman, the cat calling and the whistling was so incessant and drowning her out that it was just like everything just made me uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, it really shows how much you can accomplish with something like that, with the audio to kind of intensify the emotion and just give you that sense of discomfort and claustrophobia almost and just sort of unease.
I think sound is overlooked a lot nowadays.
Hugely so.
And I think people like back then it was another full weapon in your arsenal because of limitations of the camera.
Yeah.
But like I think people like David Lynch have always done a really masterful job with sound.
That's what I was just thinking of. Just saw Eraserhead again in the theater like last week.
Oh, yeah? Where was that?
At Midtown Art.
Damn, man. I need to keep my eyes open.
Their classic series is going right now. They did...
is it once a week?
Once a week, yeah. Every Tuesday.
Oh.
So, and, you know, only one screening for each movie.
But, right.
But yeah, that watching that movie in a theater with the sound cranked up, that really shows you like the power of sound to shape our perception of an image and just create an atmosphere and... you know, transport you to like a whole different reality.
Yeah, and in this case, severe anxiety.
Yeah,
for me. That great scene, that you know, that first trench scene, which is where we see the battlefront, which is interesting because you don't see much,
right?
Like you see the trenches.
Yeah,
you've got the
view from the binoculars.
Exactly. Which Friendly Fire made their
Wes Anderson joke. Their
rating system.
Yeah.
But you get two battlefield shots, the nighttime reconnaissance mission and then the main battle. But the first trench scene when Moreau is walking through, hello, soldier.
Yes.
Ready to kill more Germans?
Yes.
And it's just like that disconnect is so evident.
Yeah. It's
between that, officer and soldier and you know, whatever, grunt.
Yeah, and just the platitudes that he's kind of just throwing out there, like, it's like, has this guy ever fought a day in his life? Like, has he ever...
I know.
Did he just go straight from, like, the military academy to, like, you know, work his way up through the ranks without ever seeing combat? Probably, I don't know, how it worked in the French army.
Well, he has that scar, which is real.
That's true, yeah.
But that's the real guy.
Yeah, right, that's the actor.
But he cast him that way.
Yeah. You know? So that is interesting. I mean, I haven't really thought about that, like, the scar, it's sort of... making me think of like Lion King. It's sort of like the kind of almost like a Jungian idea of like the sort of the shadow or something. But yeah.
And so Kirk Douglas, the stakes are sort of set pretty early with Dax. When they're basically Moreau says like, no, this is unwinnable.
Yeah.
But he goes along with it anyway for career advancement.
Yeah.
And basically tells Kirk Douglas and tells Dax like, well, you know what this could mean for you.
Yeah. It kind of rolls downhill that way. So there's that opening scene with the two generals, and you know, he expresses his doubts about the prospect of being able to take the anthill, and then he says, you know, now General, I don't want this to in any way influence your decision or make you know this is a complete unrelated thought,
right?
But you know, if you were to take that anthill, it would be really good for your career,
and, yeah.
And he pours himself a drink at that point.
Right.
And he says, you want one? He goes, no, it's a little early in the day for me.
Yeah.
But
that
it's
was
like
an interesting exchange.
I thought. But it's sort of like, they have this way of talking without talking, of saying things and giving commands and orders and making deals without ever overtly saying anything. It's just like an understanding. And it's that sort of like specialized, like, officer kind of language,
right?
That lets them.
It's a code.
Yeah, it's a code, and it's a way of like nobody ever necessarily gave the direct order to do this or that.
Yeah,
it's all kind of implied, and it gives you enough where you can kind of distance yourself from it afterwards if it doesn't go your way or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the same thing when it goes down the next level, and it's Kirk Douglas, and you know he says, you know. Your men are not tired. You are tired.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to relieve you of your command.
He called him out and threatened him.
Yeah. And he's like, I'll relieve you of your command. You'll get some R&R. And he's again presenting it as if it's going to be a favor to him. Like, you're exhausted.
Yeah, but not
really. I'm going to let you rest up. Yeah. You know, I'll get somebody else in here who's not going to question me, and then we'll do the thing. And when you're ready, you can come back or whatever. And of course, he's not going to say okay to that.
No,
he's
not
going to abandon his men.
He's treating him like a child. Like, that's something I do with my daughter. Like,
yeah, yeah.
If she's bit like, oh, you must be really tired.
Right.
Like,
right.
Why don't we go lay down? I'm like, no, I'm not tired. Let's go play.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, oh, it's interesting how he treated him that way, because he was, by all accounts, a brave man.
Yeah.
And a good leader.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And so, I think Dax Kirk Douglas kind of makes that determination that this is a pretty suicidal mission, but the best chance my men have is for me to be there with them, you know? So if this is going to happen one way or the other, then I might as well do this. But
he couldn't, like you said, he was being threatened with being replaced.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those were his men.
Yeah. And so the thing about, you know, you're going to add a third star, all that's really not what's motivating him, even though he thinks that, you know, that might be kind of the carrot they're dangling. That's not why he chooses to do it.
Well, no, clearly.
Yeah.
Because at the end.
Right. Exactly.
Which we'll get to. But
yeah,
he gets a big old fuck you.
Yeah.
Next up, we have the reconnaissance mission. And I thought the character, I wish I would have pulled all these up. Roger.
Is he the drunkard?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Played by Wayne Morris, who
yes.
I learned on Friendly Fire had a really interesting life story.
Yeah.
He was a World War II hero.
Yeah.
After he left Hollywood, went to World War II. Was a total hero, came back to Hollywood, and was sort of like a little too late for him.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is one of his big films.
Yeah, and he's great.
He's really good.
He creates that character. You know exactly everything about that character in seconds, you know? Just his kind of cowardly nature.
Drunkard.
He feels some guilt, but most of it's just self-pity, you know? And you can't trust the guy, and he's just a worm, you know?
Yeah, there's so much... So much of this film is about cowardice and bravery.
Yeah.
But knowing Kubrick and his clear anti-war stance, it's not I don't know, man. The way he handled it was all just not obvious, because he did sort of champion Dax and his bravery and he cast the cowards in bad light.
Yeah.
But he's anti-war as well, so you get the notion that Kubrick might understand a Roger who was just like,
yeah, it's very true.
No, I'm going to hide. He's the guy who hides under the dead body.
Right, right.
He's what's his name in Platoon, Junior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and there's that exchange between the general and the shell shocked, you know, soldier.
Yeah,
and
he just fucking hits him.
Just the way he's like, you know, the other soldier standing next to him says, "Sorry, sir, he's a little bit shell shocked." And he's like,
There's no such thing
as shell shock, and, you know, knocks him upside the head. Pull it together, you know?
Yeah, it's advanced PTSD.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And but it's like they could not admit that was
mm-hmm.
a thing possible, because I don't know, it takes away from the idea that war is supposed to be this ennobling,
mm-hmm.
you know, thing that toughens you up and makes you a real man and
right.
you know, makes you brave and you know, and for country and so on, versus just it's this horrible traumatic experience that even if you're lucky enough to survive it can still have serious consequences for the rest of your life, the trauma and the kind of mental health fallout of it.
And nobody was saying this in films.
Yeah.
In
oh
1957.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely not. I think even through World War II, it was kind of like...
Sure.
I mean, even way more recently, the Iraq War even, you know, a lot of returning soldiers had heavy PTSD, and that was sort of like, you know, not talked about so much for a long time. So,
well, I mean, they're making films about that now, but they're also still making these jingoistic, Marky Mark, Taking the Hill.
Yeah, 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 exactly. I mean, this is maybe an interesting time to talk about just... There's a debate kind of throughout film history and about, like, is it possible to make such a thing as an anti-war film? Because it's very easy for something that is ostensibly critical of war to still be taken as something, like, for instance, Full Metal Jacket, I would say is an anti-war film,
mm-hmm.
but it's still, like, you know, it's the kind of thing where, like, you watch, like, Arlie Ermey's characterization as the drill sergeant. And it is, he is kind of a villain, but he's also very funny. There's something charismatic about it.
He's the one people quote.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Years and years later.
And it's kind of like, even though the film itself is set up to kind of criticize this boot camp experience and what it does to Private Pyle, you know, it's kind of like there's still probably drill sergeants that are like, I love that guy. And I quote him all the time.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
When I'm giving my soldiers shit, like I use some of his lines, you know. It's, or, you know, another example would be like something like, you know, Goodfellas. Like, it's a film that's critical of the mob, but yet it makes, kind of looks like a blast, you know, until it starts going bad.
It's also a bit of a love letter.
Yeah,
to the mob.
So, like, there is this dilemma oftentimes in film that simply, like, representing something, even in a critical light, depending on your audience and depending on what they are predisposed to take away from it, you might end up, you know, having some people that at least take that angle from it. And I feel like Paths of Glory is one of the very rare films that, like, you cannot get anything.
No, man.
Like, there's no...
there's no glory.
Yeah, there's no glory, and there's no takeaway. We're like, well, that scene was really cool. That looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know? It all just looks...
It's brutal, man.
Horrible, yeah.
And especially for the time, like, to make... There were so many times in this film where I kept waiting for something different to happen that didn't happen.
Yeah, it really undercuts your expectations of, like, what would happen in the Hollywood version of the story. Yeah.
And it was just so ballsy to, like, and apparently there was one, again, the Adam from Friendly Fire said that there was one version of the script they sent out with a good ending.
Yeah,
and
apparently.
That's how they got it financed.
Right, right.
They rewrote it, sent out the whole script again, and just counting on the fact that no one would read it.
He's going to read through to the end, yeah,
and
look at the changes, yeah.
Because no one said anything.
And, yeah, I mean, because I've heard different versions of that story where in some versions it's like even Kubrick and Harris's producer was a close collaborator at that time. Even they kind of wanted to give it like a happier ending. And it was like Kirk
it's
Douglas who was
tough,
like,
man.
No, you're not changing this. You know,
yeah,
he'd read the first draft or whatever. And yeah,
Kirk
Douglas
cut out of stone in 1957.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
I kept seeing Michael in him. It was kind of funny.
Yeah,
to see certain mannerisms.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
They are so like similar.
Yeah.
So funny.
And it's so crazy that Kirk Douglas is still alive today as well.
I know, right?
Yeah, I think he's past 100 now, right?
Oh,
he's
up
certainly
there,
up
man.
There.
He's totally up there. But jumping back to the, let me see here. He's a fucking 102.
Yeah, 102, man.
Holy shit.
Good genes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
One of my grandmothers lived to be 100.
Wow.
That's too old.
Yeah, I know, right?
I can say that.
Yeah.
So getting back to the recon scene, we can't leave that alone now because it's some of the most visually stunning stuff
absolutely.
That you see. And it's at night and like the it's so evocative, like the fear that you feel as a viewer watching them belly crawling. And one of the most
into
effective
the
things
complete
of the movie,
unknown,
is it's all unknown.
Yeah.
You never see a German soldier.
Yes.
You never see any troops. You never see anything. Every time they look, it's just nothing out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the kind of like—
it's so scary.
That's the trauma of this like modern warfare where you have people shelling from these, you know, far off locations where it's just like you're on both ends of that interaction, if you want to call it that. The people shelling and the people getting killed, neither one of them is ever going to see the other one's face or know anything about them. It's just this like industrial meat grinder that's just like been set up to kill as efficiently as and impersonally as possible.
Yeah, especially the shelling. Like every time they drop one of those in there, like I might have killed no guys or I might have killed 14 guys.
Yeah, I have no idea.
No idea.
No idea. Just raining death and, you know.
It allows your conscience to remain a little cleaner.
Maybe, yeah. But I think for me it would almost be, it's hard to say if that
worse.
Would be worse in a way because something about, at least if you're in hand-to-hand combat, like kind of face-to-face, like you're seeing that person. You're
But that also happened in World War I.
Oh, of course.
I mean, that was the shelling, but there was also like bayoneting in a guy's grill.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Very true. Very true. But I don't know. Just something about having the, at least being able to look the person in the eyes or something. I don't know. Maybe that's glorifying it way too much.
Yeah,
but
maybe so.
But I mean, I think there's just something fundamentally human about like wanting to have that social interaction, even if it's on the level of like a struggle, one trying to kill the other, battle for survival kind of thing.
Yeah.
Versus just remote, distant, detached, completely, I don't know. It's very strange.
Yeah, but the effect it had in this film was these guys are belly crawling through the night and darkness toward God knows what.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you finally get that
the flare,
man, yeah. And you see the field is littered with bodies.
Yeah.
I was just like, fuck, man, I did yeah. not see that coming.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ground was just so chewed up and
yes.
gnarly
yeah.
and like I had to rewind that scene because I didn't fully grasp
the sequence
because
yeah,
it was
yeah,
so
yeah.
dark.
Right, right, right.
But upon the second viewing, I was like, okay, so he killed his own guy.
Yeah, he threw that grenade very hastily and he kind of threw it where the guy was kind of taking cover.
Right.
And just, you know, blew him up for no reason.
Which he could have owned up to that as an accident and gotten forgiveness, I think.
Yeah.
At the time, like, they wouldn't have, like, yanked him out.
I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, accidents and friendly fire and stuff
yeah.
that, you know, just stuff that happens in
but
war.
But he doesn't, though. He had, and that's indicative of the film. There are so many opportunities for people to do the right thing.
Right, and they always choose.
They always choose the wrong
yeah.
thing.
But they kind of choose, but, you know, at the same time, Kubrick is kind of showing that, like, the system gives incentives to not do the right thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's personal advancement, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've set up the whole thing so that at every kind of juncture where somebody has a choice to do the right thing or the wrong thing,
uh-huh.
it's the smart career move to do the wrong thing pretty
right.
much every time.
Yeah, so cynical
yeah.
for 1957.
Yeah, yeah.
And that leads us to the big only battle scene, really. Walk me through that fucking shot, man.
Oh, man.
I mean, how did they do that? Was that built up on a big track? Or?
Yeah, I think it's a ton of dolly track. And built up on like a scaffolding kind of above the battlefield.
They must have thought he was crazy.
Well, it's a fun detail because, you know, as controlling as Kubrick was of the image and so on, he actually didn't look through like the viewfinder for the camera on that shot because the camera was up pretty high
mm-hmm.
and he had a fear of heights. So he made his producer, James B. Harris, go up there.
Oh, really?
And look through and kind of tell him like what you know, what you're going to see, what you're going to get.
What was his directive? Like, keep Kirk Douglas
exactly,
in frame.
Exactly. Like, no matter what happens, no matter how many people are passing in front of the lens and
yeah.
smoke and dirt and, you know, explosions going off, just keep it right locked on Kirk Douglas. And it's
Man,
amazing.
So impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be impressive now, but
I know.
For the
I know.
Year, it's just nuts.
It's unbelievable. The, I mean, the cinematography in this film is phenomenal. It's kind of, It feels like an earlier kind of school of cinematography in a way. It's black and white, clearly.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot of deep focus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of really working in depth as opposed to just doing kind of shallow depth, you know, close-ups and stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
a lot of these big wide shots and just the way that he controls the viewer's gaze to kind of
yeah.
stay on what's relevant.
Right.
You have to do with blocking and staging and very sophisticated to where it feels effortless when you're watching it. You don't really notice it, but
mm-hmm.
if you try to do it yourself, you very quickly realize like, oh, all that was very, very planned out and thought about.
Right.
And it doesn't just happen that way. It doesn't just look like that.
Yeah.
The camera doesn't just flow kind of seamlessly with the direction of the actors where you know exactly what's important to look at
mm-hmm.
and the thing that you're tracking is staying exactly in the frame. It does not happen by accident. And the cinematographer that he worked with on this film, Jörg Krause, is a German cinematographer
mm-hmm.
Who started in like the 20s. And I think he absolutely brought that kind of like silent film,
yeah.
expressionism kind of aesthetic to
right.
this film in a way that you don't see necessarily in like some of the later Kubrick pictures that are more, you know, Kubrick's own kind of
mm-hmm.
distinct aesthetic that he came up with.
Yeah, for sure. I was looking for that too. I was looking for early hints and there are a couple.
There's some zooms, you know, there's some sort of like,
right.
Certainly Kubrick, the way he likes to play with like wide angle shots sometimes
yeah.
where, especially during the trial scene where he'll have these real close-ups of the men on trial,
uh-huh.
but then it's from a wide angle lens. So you still get like the huge room
mm-hmm.
around them and the other people sitting in the chairs back behind them that feel
right.
even farther away because of the wide lens.
That really gave a sense too, like compared to there was a claustrophobia to the front.
Yeah.
And there was the rooms were so big.
Like an expansiveness.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, those huge tall ceilings. Yeah. And all that stuff felt a little bit like a throwback to earlier eras.
Absolutely.
Like it felt sometimes like a movie from the 1930s
or 40s. Exactly. It has that kind of classical Hollywood like feeling to it.
Yeah.
In a way that you really don't feel much in Kubrick's later works. It kind of,
right.
Not that it's like backward looking or traditional or, you know, a retread of anything. It's just kind of like, it's a reminder that like, yeah, the 30s were only like a couple decades ago.
Right.
In the history of cinema. And so it's interesting to see him working a little bit within that tradition, kind of.
Yeah, I was just looking to see what he made right after this, and it was Spartacus.
Right, yeah, that's an interesting
story. Which I still haven't seen.
I've never seen it either. It's one of those I don't have a great deal of interest in seeing because just of the production history of knowing that it was originally Anthony Mann was going to be directing it. He and Kirk Douglas fought quite a bit over the direction of the picture, and Kirk Douglas was producer on it, and you know, the main star. So we had a lot of pull with the studio.
So is it not a very Kubricky film?
Well, he got Mann fired off the picture, and then you know, basically they were in an emergency situation. They needed a director that could like start immediately, and so that's when he went to Kubrick and was like, "Hey, I've got this picture. I'm doing Spartacus. Like, I just had to fire the director. I need somebody that can just like come in on Monday and just like keep us going." Basically.
At what point in the film was that? Do you know?
I'm trying to think.
Like how much did he direct?
I want to say it was like halfway, maybe a little less than half, but maybe it was less than halfway through principal photography. But Kubrick's whole thing was that he didn't get any of the pre-production. He didn't get any of the scouting.
Which is
his
sort of like bread and butter.
He couldn't really do like what he would think of as his main job as director to prepare.
Right.
And to really conceive the picture from zero on.
No, I didn't know that.
So...
So it almost doesn't count.
It kind of, yeah. It's one of those where it's like Kubrick didn't really, you know, he kind of, I don't know if he ever fully disowned it per se, but it was definitely the moment at which he said to himself, like, I'm never going to be a director within the Hollywood system.
Right.
I'm going to have to do everything separate on my own, independently. Even if I work with a bigger studio, I have to maintain absolute control over everything.
Right.
And that was sort of his moment.
His Spartacus
where he learned
moment.
That. Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that a thing?
Yeah.
Or am I thinking of something else?
No, it's the Spartacus moment. I am okay. Spartacus. Yeah.
So in the battle scene, you know, we had the great tracking shot. And Kirk Douglas, just story-wise, it's amazing because he goes all the way to the front.
Yeah.
He's they're in no man's land just getting the shit kicked out of themselves.
Yeah.
And he realizes that B Company has not left the trenches. They were supposed to be their backup.
Yes.
He goes all the way back and is like, all right, let's go.
Yeah.
He got his whistle and he was ready to. And in fact, he does try to go up the ladder.
He goes up over.
And a fucking body lands on him.
Dead body just like, yeah.
Such a Kubrick thing to do, I think. Like, what could be the most symbolic and impactful thing is this. Is throwing a body on him as he's trying to climb out of this trench.
Yeah, I mean, it just says everything. You know, the metaphor is right there. Like,
it could have been a bomb going on, it could have been anything, but no, let's just throw a body on him, a dead body.
Yeah, just a reminder that, like, this place is utterly littered with bodies and the absurdity of it, really.
It really was, because it was one of those things as a viewer where you're so angry, and I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Gallipoli.
Oh, the Mel Gibson.
Yeah. It's I saw that when I was a kid, and that movie upset me so much because it was a similar thing where they're in these trenches and wave after wave gets mowed down 100% by machine gun fire, and they just keep sending waves of men because no one can get the message through to these fucking assholes in these opulent rooms. It's a bloodbath.
Yeah.
And their attitude is like, well, it's always a bloodbath early on.
Yeah.
But it's just like, no, man. Like, stop.
Yeah.
And you don't even know. There's no sense whatsoever, very purposefully in this film, of what they're trying to accomplish. Like, take the anthill. But no one knows what that means.
Oh, that's the other thing.
No one knows what the position is or what that would mean for the war.
The knowledge that—
Or a macro picture.
Yeah, like the knowledge that all this carnage and death and destruction and pain and suffering, like— It was all for just nothing.
Well, and
like,
it was called an anthill.
Yeah,
like, that was no accident.
Right. I mean, it's just—
You could have called it like, you know, Bald Mountain or something.
Yeah,
but
it's funny. Like, this film goes so close. I mean, it is absurd in so many ways, but somehow it never thinks to make that funny, you know, the way Strangelove does.
This could have been tweaked slightly and been the darkest comedy of all time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But instead, it keeps it right at the edge of that. You know, it never goes over into just laughing at the absurdity of it. It's just kind of like, this is absurd, and it's more meant to anger you or maybe drive you to despair or something. But, you know, a line from Strangelove like, gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. Something like that, you know.
Oh, yeah. There's no fighting in the war room?
Yeah. The idea that, like, you know, we talked about this in regard to, like, a lot of Kubrick's films, the way he shows that society creates these rules and, like, frameworks for things in order to give them this sheen of respectability or of just, like, the way things are done, like the duels in Barry Lyndon.
Right.
Or, you know, some of the things like the kind of ceremonial quality of the orgy in Eyes Wide Shut.
Right.
Just like we like the kind of garnish that we put on what is just utterly crazy behavior. Is on display in this film as well, but it just doesn't quite tip over into like laughing at any of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone knew how to do that at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think even Stanley Kubrick knew how to do that yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what, Strangelove was
64.
7 years later.
Yeah. And it's actually, it's interesting because Strangelove is the picture where Kubrick and Harris, his you know, big producing partner up to that point, where they went their separate ways because Harris did want to play Strangelove straight. Mm-hmm. It wasn't called Strangelove at the time, of course. That would be ridiculous to say the script, Dr. Strangelove, we're going to play that straight.
Mm-hmm.
But they were working from, I think, a book called Failsafe that was about...
He always works from a book, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, he was interested in this sort of like the Cold War, the sort of mutually assured destruction, the kind of doomsday machines where if Russia detects... you know, a bomb launched from the United States and it launches its own bombs and we just wipe each other out.
Yeah, war games.
And so Kubrick had, you know, he was fascinated by this idea and he had the idea to make it, you know, more absurd, more comedic. And Harris wanted to just kind of play it straight. And so Harris said to Kubrick, you know, we got a real problem here. I think... I want to tell you how to make your film, and I don't want to do that.
Oh,
and Kubrick said to Harris, he said, well, you should direct. Not meaning you should direct this, but you've gotten to a point now where you
wanna,
have a vision.
Right.
You ought to go and make films now.
Did he?
He did. Yeah, what? He made like 4 or 5 features, I want to say.
What's his name?
James B. Harris.
James B. Harris.
I don't think I've ever seen any of his films. I know he made one in the early 70s called Some Call It Loving that has kind of a cult following. You know, he never had like the success or the notoriety of Kubrick, certainly.
Yeah, the Bedford Incident. Don't know that one, I don't think.
But he did have, you know, a directing career. He made probably 4 or 5 films at least. And,
yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And he remained very friendly with Kubrick until the very end. So it wasn't like they had a falling out.
Right.
It was just kind of like the two men really respected each other. And Kubrick was sort of like, no, man, you're ready. Like, you have... You've understood like what it is to be a filmmaker. You have a point of view now, so you have to go beyond just like enabling somebody else's point of view, kind of.
And so then he goes out and makes Boiling Point with Wesley Snipes, and Kubrick loses all respect. He made a couple of pictures with James Woods too. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So the battle happens, utter failure.
Yeah.
And. We
got to talk about during the battle.
Yeah, during the battle, yeah. Moreau tries to fucking bomb his own troops.
Yes, unbelievable.
Like,
unbelievable.
And it's funny in a movie about cowardice and bravery. Like the most cowardly act is probably that, or one of you know.
It's hard to get much worse than that. Firing on your own people just to kind of
because he was as punishment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, well, they're not charging, so let's fucking kill them.
And just like a child that didn't get its way or something, just throwing a tantrum, you know?
Absolutely.
And
no one will do it, though.
Yeah, the whole chain of command, like the radio operator who has to kind of talk, he doesn't want to do it.
Uh-huh.
Finally, he does radio over. Of course, the guy on the other end is like, oh, that's our own position. We can't do that.
Yeah, he's like, I need a written
order. And there's the whole exchange about how... you know, there will be no written order. Do this right now, you know, or I will have you killed, you know, yourself. And it's like, well, what if you get killed, General? Then I'm going to look like the one who did this.
Right.
You know, And then there's that great line, which is kind of the equivalent almost of "Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room," where he says, "If they won't face German bullets, then by God they'll face French ones."
Yeah,
which is just like, wow,
so absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
See, that's to me the moments. One of those moments where he borders on black comedy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like that line in Strangelove,
yes,
would have been taken.
Would have gotten a laugh.
Yeah,
yeah.
Dark comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Brutal, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we should briefly mention the accents, you know.
They're, yes,
they're
the
French
language
soldiers, but
thing,
there's
yes,
like, there's English accents, there's American accents.
Yeah.
Just sort of one of those things.
It is one of those things. I mean, I did think about this because it had been, I've seen it twice recently.
Yeah.
I watched it once when we were going to do this.
The first
couple weeks ago, yeah. And then it had been a couple weeks, so I watched it again this morning just to like get it really fresh.
Sure.
But before then, it had been several years since I had seen the film. And then when I started watching it again, I was like, oh, yeah, this is in English, even though they're French soldiers. And
yeah,
not only is
it's
it
hard
in English,
to remember sometimes,
but it's like, you know, a lot of it's like kind of Brooklyn, like very
yeah,
vernacular. Like,
well, and Kirk Douglas is, I still don't think of him as a French soldier.
Yeah,
in
yeah,
this
yeah,
movie
exactly, exactly.
At all. I mean, he's being very American.
Yeah,
in the way he yeah, carries himself and acts.
Exactly. And that's like maybe one kind of flaw you could point to in a way is that, you know, if you were really going to try to depict this incident playing out with like the French military, the mannerisms mm-hmm, would be different.
Yeah.
Some of the kind of like the conversations would probably have a slightly different character. They might be
yeah,
a little more, I don't know, just culturally it would feel
sure,
different than it does here. But this is almost like a translation in the sense of like you're transposing the dynamics that would happen in France to more like an American context where it's like
yeah,
these soldiers would kind of be talking in this like street kind of vernacular.
I wonder why I didn't make them American.
Yeah, well, because
like what was
I mean, obviously
a historical
the
reason for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. I think honestly, like even to make the film with it being as stridently kind of anti-military, anti-war as it is.
Oh. He's like, no, it's about the French
yeah,
army.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that
I think making it about the French was oh, really like that kind of degree of separation enough because the film did have troubles. Like it was not shown in France.
Yeah.
It was not shown, I think, in several of the European countries.
Right.
Did not show it for a very long time.
Hmm.
And it was because it was too provocative. It was too, you know, stridently
yeah,
against. And it, you know, meanwhile, it opened up and played in the United States without any problems. But if you'd made that film about the American
right,
side of the, I mean, it would have been
well, that's
a bloodbath.
Maybe
yeah,
that's the joke is it is a movie
yeah,
about
yeah,
American
yeah,
soldiers.
That's,
they're
yeah,
wearing French uniforms.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, there is a certain like, in terms of like the military palaces and so on is,
yeah,
is very European, very French. But
yeah, and the I looked up historically the notion of drawing lots for execution mm-hmm, for this was something the French did.
Yeah.
So that was historically accurate.
And I think even the sort of like in previous wars, like there was a sort of understanding that if you turned around and tried to like retreat from the front line that
mm-hmm,
there would be people there to
yeah,
fire on you.
There's a consequence.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah, just like, yeah, it's amazing. Like,
yeah.
Go meet your death.
Yeah.
Bravely.
Yeah.
Like, and there's still, you know, that's still the notion.
Right.
In battle, I think.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's sad. So what happens after is they basically, I feel like they feel like they have to make an example of some men.
Mm-hmm.
Because word is getting around, or word will get around, that they retreated.
If they let the retreat stand unpunished,
right,
then it's going to be rational for everybody to retreat at that point,
right?
Because there's nothing to be gained by going out there.
Yeah,
it's just like, so what? We took the anthill. Who cares?
Yeah,
like, you know.
And Moreau initially wants what, like 100 men or something?
Yes. Yeah.
To die.
Right.
And then they negotiate that down to 12 and then to 3.
Yeah, he takes it down to 3, which is, I wasn't sure why, because the—
Because he had it at 12.
Yeah, he had it at 12. It seemed like they were all on board for 12.
He said, now you've got me down to a dozen men.
Yeah.
But you know why I think he does it. I think it allows him to seem compassionate.
Maybe so.
Because he's like, here's what I'll do.
Maybe so,
basically,
yeah.
I'll pick one man from each unit or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's what I'll grant you.
Yeah, yeah. And gosh, the way the three are picked— The arbitrariness
up,
of it is
what's
well,
up with Timothy Carey? What is his deal? Why is he socially undesirable?
Mm,
I don't get that.
I mean, just his demeanor, I guess, because he seems like he's kind of a pill, you know, kind of a large personality, you know,
but socially undesirable is it?
He's just kind of not like, well liked by people, you know. Okay. He doesn't have any friends, basically.
See, I couldn't tell if there was something not said on screen.
Yeah. Oh, if he was like for some reason they like were kind of prejudiced against him or something. Or,
maybe. Yeah. For any reason.
Yeah.
But the word socially undesirable, I think, I don't know, hit me in a way where I was like, what's up with this guy?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like it's not like he's just a jerk.
Right, right.
Like it made it sound like he might have had a I don't know. I mean, in the 19 teens.
Yeah.
He could have been an atheist, and that could
have
been
true. That's true.
Or he could have been gay, and
yeah,
that could have
yeah,
been
yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it could be, and you know, that's another thing that like the kind of cultural French context would shed more light on, like whatever that initially
right.
would have been versus what it would be in the American context. But
but the three guys that they pick, it's really interesting because you know one is him who is. Not pleasant.
It's basically just I don't like you.
Yeah,
you know,
an unpleasant.
This has
character.
To be somebody, and you're kind of a pain in the ass. So
yeah.
Sorry, it's going to be you.
They pick the one guy who goes out on the mission that actually does. Ralph Meeker played
yeah.
him in the film. Corporal Philippe.
Yeah.
I can't see his last name here, but he was one of the only brave guys. But he's got dirt on Roger
exactly.
as being a coward. As,
yeah.
Or not a coward. A killer.
Which is almost like him picking him is a kind of murder because it's sort of like, you've got some dirt on me.
So I'm going to send you to your death.
Yeah, I'm going to kill two birds with one stone here. Like, I'm going to get to pick somebody from my regiment and I'm going to help myself out. I'm going to cover my tracks.
And then the great Joe Turkle, who when I was watching this, I was like, man, if the years had been flip-flopped, he could have played Lou Reed.
Yes.
In the Lou
exactly.
Reed story.
He looks like just like Lou
Joe
Reed.
Turkle.
This fitting image of Lou Reed. Yeah.
Totally, man. I was like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. He looks just like Lou Reed.
Lloyd from The Shining.
Right. Yeah. Of course. And Blade Runner.
Yeah.
He's still alive, too, by the way. He is what – and they even make a point to say, like, in court, like, I have all these examples of this is one of my bravest
yeah.
soldiers.
Yeah.
And he has been decorated for his bravery
yeah.
and drew a lot to get in here.
Yeah.
And no one fucking cares.
Yep, yep.
It's just such a like,
yeah,
I mean,
he,
it's just
he drew
Kubrick.
The shortest straw, basically,
yeah.
literally, you know?
I mean, Kubrick could have done anything. I don't know how it worked in the book, but he could have gone any direction with the three people that he picked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he went a very distinct direction with each one of them.
Yes.
Instead of making them all super brave.
Exactly, exactly.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. And I think it speaks to how arbitrary it must have felt.
Yeah, and just the different reasons they're chosen for, you know. Some is just bad luck, some because they're not well liked.
Right.
One because, you know, he's a liability to the higher officer.
Right.
So, just showing the different kind of motivations and, you know, in a way it's got to be the most kind of difficult to grasp is the one that is just arbitrary. You drew the shortest straw, so now you're going to lose your life, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Because your hand picked the wrong one out of the hat, you know?
Yeah, and part of something Adam said on Friendly Fire was like, as a viewer, he almost felt like Kubrick was saying like, which one are you?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it made me think, I was like, yeah, that kind of
yeah.
did feel
yeah.
that way.
And and also his character, in particular the Joe Turkle character, like he's the professor, he's the philosopher, he's the
yeah.
thinker. And
but he also hit a priest.
Yeah, yeah, but he also punched a priest. And it's like he's almost he's the closest to kind of the point of view of the film, like the moral core of the film, I want to say,
mm-hmm.
because he is the one who is most kind of consciously grappling with the absurdity of the situation and the meaninglessness of it all.
Yeah.
He has that conversation before the night before they have the big.
Is he one of the two guys?
Yes. He's
okay.
one of the two guys. He's
the
one. He's the one who's basically, there's the one guy lying down in the bunk and then there's the other guy kind of sitting next to
so
him.
So he's saying it's better to get shot in the head
yeah.
than shot in the ass.
He's
oh no, the other way around.
The other way around.
Yeah.
Exactly. He's like, there's a lot of bones in your head. That's super
right.
painful, but in your ass is just meat. So,
yeah. Such a weird scene.
So he's basically saying he's kind of making almost like a stoic kind of argument saying it's not death so much that we fear because you've agreed that there's good ways and bad ways to die.
Mm-hmm.
And we both also agree that the quicker and less painful way to die is better than the painful and drawn out way to die.
Yeah.
It's like, but in both cases, it's like the pain that you're worried about.
Yeah.
It's the thing before you die that you're freaked out about. death and everything after is kind of a moot point. Because you don't know. You don't exist anymore. And that was very much the idea of the Stoics too, where it was like, you know, death is not the thing to fear because when you're dead, you will not be here to fear anything.
Right.
So it's just very interesting that Kubrick kind of leaves that level of like kind of, again, philosophical kind of thought so close to the surface of the film, and then has that soldier put through that whole process of finding out he's going to die and not being able to do anything about it.
Well, and then, I mean...
And he's the only one that's not in denial about it,
you know? But what happens to him? It's one of the more brutal things I've ever seen in a movie, man.
Yeah.
And I don't think many films these days would have the balls to do it.
I know.
And I can't believe in 1957
yes.
that Kubrick had a soldier hauled out on a gurney,
yeah.
propped up, and had his cheek pinched.
Yeah, they say pinch his cheeks. So, you know,
so,
if you pinch his
they want
his
him
cheeks,
to be awake
he might,
when
he might,
dies.
You might rouse him for a second because the journal wants him to be conscious before
dude.
He dies.
I still can't get over it. And even when he's being
so
treated
cool.
By the medic or whatever, they're basically saying, like, you know, this isn't going to, like, matter.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
they will still execute you
yeah.
in your stretcher.
He's like, well, surely they're not going to execute a
yeah.
man in this condition. And he's like, no, I checked, and they wanted to go ahead, so it's going to happen.
That's one of the toughest things I've ever seen in a movie, man, is seeing that guy propped up,
yeah.
Basically unconscious,
yeah.
and waking him to shoot him.
And again, it's that level of absurdity and
yeah.
irony, you know, the you can't fight in here, it's the war room kind of thing, where
I know,
you're
man.
Executing a man on a stretcher who's practically dead already.
Yeah. I can't imagine how this went over in 1957.
I know.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's hard to watch now.
It was also, it kind of made me think that character, the kind of philosopher soldier,
yeah.
makes me think a lot of The Thin Red Line.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
And in particular because—
Jim Caviezel?
Yeah, yeah, the Jim Caviezel character. And in particular because The Thin Red Line has the same sort of story element, where mm-hmm. there's that whole section where Nick Nolte wants to take that hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Elias Koteas who's mm-hmm. playing the
great.
And he makes the same kind of determination where he's like, sir, we cannot take that hill. Like
mm-hmm.
it's a suicide mission. We just can't do it. And he also defies the orders to take the hill.
And
Nolte
blows
his stack.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting that scenario, you know, I'm sure Malick was well aware of Paths of Glory.
Well, and that was just
and they're also
war.
Based on, you know, novels
yeah.
about World War II in this case. But they're both working from books, I guess, where this happened. But it's interesting the kind of depiction of insubordination, you know, and men kind of choosing to defy the orders when they know fully well that they're probably happening for less than honorable reasons, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the difference, like, with these soldiers. It's, I think they, it's not like they were just cowards because they didn't want to die, because I think many of them would have laid their life
right.
to make a difference. But I think they understood the futility of it
exactly,
all.
Exactly, exactly.
And
yeah.
we're like, what? I'm not going up there to die for what?
Yeah.
For the
yeah.
anthill?
It's like the fairy tale story that you know we're kind of given about like the glory of battle and so
yeah.
on. Like it's something's not adding up here. You know, this is not what I was promised. I was promised like a glorious death if there
right.
was to be a death. You know, it would be in service of some greater cause, and it would place me alongside this pantheon, this great tradition of
mm-hmm.
like other men who went to battle and fought and sacrificed for the country or for
right.
freedom or whatever. But
getting mowed down 3 feet
yeah, just,
out of the trench is
just,
not...
Just because I'm like a number on a balance sheet for
yeah.
a general who doesn't give a shit. It's just like,
yeah.
you know, the contradictions are too strong and they just can't do it anymore,
yeah.
you know? Yeah.
So they get to court, and Kirk Douglas is lobbied to be the defense
yes.
Lawyer,
yeah.
essentially.
In this little kangaroo court
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
show
he,
trial.
He transforms immediately into whiz-bang
yeah,
attorney.
It's true.
And is just constantly rebuffed
oh, yeah.
at every turn
yeah.
and just trying to be heard.
Yes.
And it was so frustrating to watch.
It's like they were saying on Friendly Fire, like,
yeah, man,
you're all like amped up for like, this is the courtroom drama
yeah.
moment. There's going to be a gotcha. There's going to be
other
like
movie,
a,
you, that would
some
have
righteous
happened.
Indignation. That's
uh-huh.
really going to like, they may lose, but damn it, they're going to make their point, yeah, you know, and they're going to know that they're in the wrong and all that.
Like,
and
we might have lost the battle, but yeah, we're going to win the war. Yeah. But you get the feeling, you leave this movie going like, well, we lost the battle, we lost the war.
Yeah.
No one wins. Nobody
on
dies.
That, yeah, nobody on that panel was in the least bit, their conscience was not affected. They were not shamed. They were not, you know, it didn't
there
make them
even
lose sleep at night. They did not care.
Like, I kept waiting for even just a shot of maybe the main, I guess he was the judge or whatever, mm-hmm. the main guy presiding
right.
Just waiting for just a glimpse of like, of acknowledgement that I'm doing the wrong thing, even if I do it anyway.
Yeah.
But man, there's just nothing.
And the way that they, when the men explain themselves and they say, well, sir, I actually couldn't get out of the trench because, you know, X, Y, Z.
They're like, that's not the question.
Yeah. They're like, no,
did you advance?
Yeah,
or did
how
you
far
retreat?
Did you get? He's
yeah.
like, they don't even want to hear it.
No,
you know? They
doesn't
don't even
matter
hear
the
it.
Circumstance.
And then Kirk Douglas tries to like call a witness. He's like, no, we're not going to call any witnesses. Yeah. Just, you know, it's fine. We're done.
Oh, God, it was so frustrating. Well, like one of the more, and I know in Friendly Fire, Roderick was so like upset because he loves, and I do too. I think we all love a good courtroom scene.
Yeah.
And we're conditioned to, courtroom scenes generally go a certain direction,
yeah, yeah,
and we're
yeah,
so
yeah.
conditioned by that.
Yeah.
And Kubrick just pulls the rug out from under
yeah.
you.
Yeah, we're not used to just seeing like...
It's almost cruel.
Yeah, it's very cruel.
As a director.
It's cruel and like a... Yeah, kind
like
of like a meta cinematic way. Like, like you've seen so many other movies where you're kind of used to these tropes of... like the courtroom reversal, the underdog, all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, no, in this case, it's like the iron boot of the system just kind you know, on your face. And there will be no justice. There will be no
man.
Reversal. No
Shawshank moment.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Coming.
Yeah.
Like imagine if Shawshank had ended with like Andy and Red dying in
chair.
Prison getting shot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like movies like that, like they'll shoot the one guy trying to get his GED or whatever.
Right.
And that's a brutal, painful moment.
Yep.
Just to set you up for all of the justice that rains
down on
the audience at the end.
Exactly.
And you were sort of waiting for this. But
the catharsis,
like,
that sort of like,
yeah.
oh, justice is finally served.
Right. You don't get any catharsis.
No.
And that leaves you just like exhausted.
Yeah.
At the end of a 90-minute film.
Yeah.
Maybe I didn't need more of this.
No, I know. I mean, it is pretty bleak and it is pretty relentless. So
yeah.
if it had gone on for 2 hours, maybe it would have felt like,
just
you know,
punishment.
Enough already. You know, we get it.
So the prosecutor, played by Richard Anderson from $6 Million Man, which is what I knew him from, he's so glib and smug and just so proud of himself.
Yes.
And like, it's so despicable because he's like, that would be sort of smug and gross if he had a real case against a bad person.
Yeah, yeah.
But the way he's acting with these guys, it's like, dude, like these are your own men.
Fellow soldiers.
That didn't like deserve this. And you were just so pleased with yourself.
Yeah.
That you're sending them to their death.
And it's weird because it's like, why? Why would you be that smug about it when you know,
I don't know.
That it's being done for political reasons? And
it was almost like Dax, how it plays out. And if it were another film, Dax would have been like a big rabble rousing malcontent,
right.
That had caused them problems and that they were trying to really put a cap on.
You're right, right,
but
right.
Like, none of that's true either.
No, yeah.
It's really confounding.
Yeah.
Fucking Kubrick, man. Like, leave it to him to like just undo everything you think about what this kind of movie can and should be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Just there's no justice in the world. There's no, nobody's going to save you at the last minute.
How old was he?
God, he still had to be quite young.
I mean, was he in his 20s?
Let's see. What year was Kubrick born?
I just typed in Kubrick age, and they're like, zero.
He's born in 28, and this is 57, so he's what, 29? Did I do my math right
there?
Yeah,
man. He's in his 20s when he made this movie.
Yeah, because I'm sure they shot it, you know, a little bit.
Well, I know he very famously got into a big brawl with, because I think he was just starting with doing a lot of takes. And
right,
sort of coming
yes.
into his own as far as that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the character of the major general or whatever his name was.
Monju.
Yeah, who was a silent film star,
Adolf Monju,
had been around for many, many years.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, I'm sure you know the story.
Yes.
Got in a brutal fight.
Yes.
About how many takes he had to do, and I won't do this, and who are you? Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
Kubrick just let him do the whole thing, kind of
exactly.
Like, all right, let's just go again.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they talk about how, you
have
know,
your
Kubrick,
tantrum.
Kubrick was not a shouter. He was not somebody that was going to try to win an argument by yelling over somebody.
I think, like, he knows the futility of that.
Yeah, he just kind of, like, sat there with his arm folded, and, you know, when the guy was done, he kind of, like, had his tantrum. He's like, all right, you finished? Let's go again, you know?
And he went again.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Even on the battlefield scene, the tracking shot of Kirk Douglas, Douglas said to Kubrick, I'm only going to give you like two or three of these, so let's make them count, you know?
I mean, that was a tough scene.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
can't imagine them. I mean, did they do two or three?
I don't even know. Like, yeah, probably not that many because, I mean, it was such all the pyrotechnics and
yeah,
all the kind
no
of
way.
Like to reset after that would take probably half a day. So, I mean,
yeah.
they might have only done one or two, and then that was it. And it was clearly enough.
Well, the mastery on display in the two battlefield shots, the reconnaissance mission at night and then that one,
yeah.
of the mastery of filmmaking and using light and like exposing film and knowing, because it was especially in that battlefield scene.
Yeah.
It was so key what you see and what you don't
yes.
see and when you see and don't
yes.
see it.
Yeah.
To pull that off so well, like
yeah.
it just shows complete mastery of always like when I worked in film, it was they were still shooting on film.
Yeah.
And I always used to marvel even then about the gaffers and the cinematographers just being able to translate in their head, like, I know what this is going to look like when it's printed.
Yeah, you can just kind of rely on your light meter and then
yeah.
you know the ratios and everything.
You got to trust that shit.
So you know that, like,
it's like flying by instruments almost.
Yeah. It's like if, you know, to like that the shot with the flares, for instance.
Right.
It's like, okay, I know these bodies in the foreground are going to be like this many stops under key. So that's just going to be black on film until the flare comes up, and then it's going to
yeah.
like read at this other
but
reading.
But it's a time where you just – it's not like they got playback or anything. You
there's
just
no
have
video
to
tap.
Shoot
there's
that
no
shit and
like,
trust it.
Yeah.
And, you know.
You're purely relying on your instruments to tell you like
yeah.
what the light reading is and what the sensitivity of the film is. And
just such a pure time.
I mean, I think that really shows Kubrick's discipline and is also his like his photography background too, I think.
Oh, sure.
Like the kind of – like, you know, the photographer Ansel Adams had this whole zone system idea where, again, it's,
I don't know
it's,
about that.
It's essentially where it's a way to kind of control the exposure of an image. And it's a way of looking at like the shadows, the midtones, and the mm-hmm. highlights and how you expose an image so that you get that beautiful gradation in black and white. Cause Adams is like a landscape photographer.
Sure.
And just knowing that the clouds are going to be reading all the way up here at the, like the top of the kind of exposure
mm-hmm.
and the shadows in the valleys are going to be down here. But if I expose exactly this way, all that's going to register on the film and mm-hmm. then I'm going to print it, develop it a certain way
yeah.
so that I'm going to retain all that dynamic range. And, you know, this was all way pre-digital, way pre-having any kind of intelligent auto-exposure
sure.
system, histogram, whatever. So it's just pure technical discipline
yeah.
and
experience.
Yeah, experience, exactly. I mean, Kubrick got started so early with
yeah.
still photography. And if you look at his still photos too, I mean, a lot of them, even though they're kind of like Life magazine kind of documentary style,
mm-hmm.
like they're just technically like perfect, you know, a lot of the time.
Yeah. I mean, this movie could have been in color. They were certainly
oh, I know.
Shooting plenty of color.
Yeah, it's interesting how long he continued to work in black and white after color
yeah.
was, you know, widely
I mean,
kind of
went,
had been adopted.
He went color with... Well, was Lolita color or black
no.
and white?
No, Lolita is black and white.
So he didn't shoot
first color,
color
film
until 2001?
Yeah, is that, God, is that correct? Well,
yeah,
Spartacus,
man.
But...
Oh, well, sure.
You know, like not...
If we're counting that.
Yeah, if we count that, but...
Like he can walk in and
right.
make half the film black
exactly,
and white.
Exactly, exactly. So, man, isn't that crazy?
He's like, well, there's one condition.
Yeah.
I'll save your picture, but the second half is going to be in black and white.
Yeah, but isn't that wild to think about that...
Yeah,
the
dude,
first
1968?
Time, the first time he works in color is 1968.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that he didn't go back and do like one more black and white picture after that.
I'm sure he would have loved to. You know, at the same time, Kubrick did have a, for somebody that was such a singular kind of artist and just wanted to do things his way, he did always have kind of a weird in the sense of like an auteur anyway, an odd fixation on commercial success and on,
yeah.
you know, wanting a movie to perform well and thinking in terms of like what would work in this marketplace. Like it's why he doesn't ultimately do Napoleon is because
right.
he's convinced and the studio backing is convinced that it's not going to be commercially viable. And, you know, in some of his casting choices and so on, and picking like Tom Cruise or Ryan O'Neill, et cetera.
Yeah.
Or making The Shining after Barry Lyndon as a way to kind of re-ingratiate himself commercially.
Right.
So, you know, the decision to not go back to black and white at some point could really have been like, that time has passed and, you know, audiences today want to see color.
Right.
I don't, you know, like I said, as single-minded as Kubrick was, I don't think he was the kind of artist or thinker or filmmaker that necessarily would want to do something that was purely like self-indulgent or,
right.
or like, I'm going to make this arty thing that's like out of its time and people are not going to get it. And he really was concerned with like wanting to connect with like a broader audience and
yeah.
kind of be like part of this culture, not just sort of be like in the art house kind of like
no,
side
I think,
division.
I think
you know?
He wanted to make really good films that a lot of people saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting. Paths of Glory. I just looked now. Did not have any Academy Award nominations.
Wow.
Not one.
Wow.
Got a WGA nominee award for the script. And then like...
Surprise, nothing for Kirk Douglas? Nothing
a
for...
A BAFTA nomination yeah. for Best Film, of
wow.
course.
Wow.
And then like France and Italy and some other countries awarded it. But God, not a single Academy Award nomination.
That's crazy.
Same
wonder...
year as, what's it called? All Quiet on the Western
Front.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
It's interesting. All right. So we're at the end of the film and the kangaroo court happens. Mm. And of course, it goes the only way it could go.
Yeah.
And then we have that long, well, the pre-execution scene where they're getting everyone ready.
Yeah.
Is tough.
Yes.
Because that's when the guy tries to connect with he knew the dude, right?
He knew they knew each other. And
that's when he's like, man, there's one way we're going to do this.
Yeah.
Or there's two ways we can do this. You can
yeah.
stand up and walk out of here.
Right.
Or we're going to pull you out of here.
You can do this the honorable way or you can make it really ugly. But
yeah.
it's not going to change the outcome. So you might as well
no.
die with some dignity kind
yeah.
of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I have that conversation with my daughter a lot too. Not dying with dignity, but like, hey, listen, I can pick you up and carry you to
yeah.
bed screaming.
Right.
Or you can walk into bed.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
And like one is better.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she didn't get it.
No, of course. There's that it's just something very human that you don't want to go quietly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That long march, man, that's a very iconic scene. There's a couple of POV shots.
Yeah, you see there's like a guy taking a photograph.
Yeah.
And you see, of course, the generals looking on.
Which is a little bit of a future Kubrick
yes.
style thing
yes. yeah.
that we don't get to see a ton of in this film.
Yeah. We see it a little bit in the trenches too, I think.
Yeah,
there's
a little
kind
bit.
Of the reverse, like where you're looking,
right.
you're watching Kirk Douglas, then you're kind of seeing his POV, the men looking at the
right.
camera almost.
Stepping out of the way
yeah,
as
yeah.
he walks.
Yeah.
But this the drum beat, the incessant drum
yeah.
beat
yeah.
marching toward their death is just like, and it's spectacle, you know? It's
it
like,
is, I know.
It's like
it's
theater almost.
Really sickening like to think that, yeah, it's not just enough to have this execution, but it's actually like a ceremony. It's an event. It's
yeah.
It's aestheticized. It's like they're doing it on this, you know, this European kind of chateau
uh-huh.
that they're on, and like the very the straight rows of trees and
yeah.
the road,
it's
the
beautiful.
Pavement. It's very beautiful. It's very symmetrical,
uh-huh.
and it just hammers home that feeling of like you're sort of on this track that you cannot deviate from.
Right.
And everything is kind of preordained and there is no possibility to break outside of it.
Right.
And I like the drums on the soundtrack are kind of enhancing that feeling of being locked in, of being
yeah.
powerless to kind of, because it is just this relentless march
yeah.
and there will be no sort of deviation from the ranks.
Yeah. And the, I guess we need to jump back a little bit because there's only one even thing that approaches satisfaction in this movie, which is where Kirk Douglas calls in Roger
yeah.
and is like, you're going to be the guy to lead the execution.
You've got
to
do
like,
the...
I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
He's like, it's real easy.
Right.
Here's what you do.
Yeah.
You approach each man and offer him and
a
look
blindfold.
Him in the eye and offer
yeah.
him a blindfold.
Yeah.
And then you raise your sword and you say, ready, aim, fire.
Yeah.
Like, it's really easy.
It's
that's
very simple.
That's
yeah.
all you got to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he tries to refuse the order and he's like, no. Because he knows.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that approaches satisfaction in
yeah,
this movie.
Yeah.
But you don't even get that because you're thinking, all right, well, this guy is finally going to be outed as a piece of shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he offers this blindfold, and the guy is clearly going to do something.
Yeah, yeah.
And he doesn't do anything.
No,
he just refuses it.
He just has a kind of a sheepish, like, sorry, you know, he apologizes to him. But it's just kind of...
It's perfect for the film,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, yeah, but there is no... There's just no catharsis.
Takes
there's
all
no,
the air out of it.
Yeah, there's nothing, you know. Yeah, it's just a bummer.
Yeah, yeah. And then the actual moment where it shows the three getting shot, the one in the stretcher, is just such an image.
Yeah.
Like that it's just burned in your brain.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I mean, even the way that... You know, they do ready, aim, fire. They shoot. The three men kind of fall down.
Mm-hmm.
And then he cuts away just a second or two later.
Yeah.
He doesn't even linger on the shot for very long, which I think there's just something so abrupt about it that makes it worse in a way. It makes it hit harder because I feel like if he'd lingered on that shot, there would almost be this sense of like mourning or of these guys who were really wronged and just the injustice of it all. But it would be sort of like a... You could think of like a tribute or something, you know?
Yeah, or like Kubrick literally saying, look, everyone, see?
Yeah.
See, look at what's happened.
Look
at the result.
Yeah.
Like he cuts away so quickly.
He cuts away so quickly. It's like they're dead. They're gone. It's forgotten.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to remember them.
Well, which is the point, I think. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but it's
just like,
it's
here's
so
how
harsh,
arbitrary,
you know?
It was. Like, you know, we're like, out.
You know, like typically when you think about one of the main characters dying in a film, like even if they are dead, there's that moment where like the camera's going to linger on them and there's going to be like the swell of music that's like,
yes,
we're saying goodbye and when we're kind of like letting go of this person,
yeah,
but he just yanks you right away from it. And, you know, the next thing you see is the generals are sitting down, they're
breakfast,
having a meal, they're like going about things. Like,
yeah,
I mean, they're talking
man.
About that it went so well and everything.
Yeah.
They're clearly not the least bit affected or worried about any of it.
Yeah, I mean, that scene is another one that approaches what could have been black comedy.
Yeah.
Is them just cut to them eating pastries,
yeah,
and things.
Yeah.
And there's always a chance one could do something and leave a bad taste.
Yeah.
But they really just did a splendid job.
And that
died
room that,
wonderfully.
That room that they're sitting in, you think about Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
Those surroundings, very similar.
Yeah.
You think about Sidney Pollack's kind of like pool room in Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a real continuity there, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of space. It's the same kind of people that, again and again, he's kind of returning to in all these films.
Yeah, and then, you know, the big moment at the end is when the head general basically says, you still think, well, first of all, backing up really quick to the execution.
Yeah.
I still thought there would be a stay of execution.
Some last minute thing.
Until those bullets ran
because
out.
Because there is that scene between Kirk Douglas and Monju where...
Yeah, where he tells them.
Yeah, he tells them
Moreau tried to fire on his
Moreau
men.
Moreau gave the order and I have all these sworn statements.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of think...
Like that's it.
Maybe there is going to be some 11th hour reprieve.
I was just waiting for someone to be running in with papers.
Like ready,
saying,
aim,
stop.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it just didn't happen.
No.
But then they pick up the next day. Moreau is very cheerfully sort of outed by the other general. And he's like, so, you know, we're going to have to look into this.
Yeah.
Like, but it shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, we'll just look into this.
Yeah.
Like, this is what you should want, you know.
Right.
To have an investigation so you can be cleared.
Yeah.
And like,
He's just like, yeah, he knows exactly what's really being said.
Yeah, like, and I get the feeling that after this film ends that he is going to get his.
Right, right.
But you don't get that satisfaction.
Oh, and you do get to hear him say, I'm the only person in this whole story that, you know, has acted honorably at every stage.
Which is
stage.
Just
you
such
know,
fucking bullshit.
And, you know, and then also the way he turns around, he's like, well, I'm a soldier. And he charges out. It's just like, oh,
like, are
man.
You?
The self-regard, the kind of,
oh yeah,
the pure delusion. Like, you realize that.
He believes it.
Yeah, he believes it. It's like in that way, he's not even aware of how corrupt and terrible he is because he's sincere in some horrible way.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he's so deluded. He's so out of touch with reality.
Yeah, so that approaches a little bit of satisfaction, but you don't quite get there.
Right. It's a pretty hollow victory because
the
same institutions, the same mechanisms are going to be in
nothing's
place.
Nothing's changed.
And you get rid of that guy, there will be another guy just like him that'll fill his place. So even taking him down is a pretty, pretty hollow victory.
And the big moment, though, is when Kirk Douglas, I think there's this assumption that, like, you're one of us.
Yeah.
So, like, you did this all along to get Moreau. Like, that's why you outed him.
Exactly.
And the indignation.
Yeah.
From Dax is just off the charts.
That's like his one kind of big moment of like,
yeah,
know.
That and his courtroom
right, right.
summation.
Yeah.
When he just talks about like being a, basically being ashamed to be a member of the human race.
Yeah, yeah.
So hardcore. And then he just dresses down the general.
Yeah.
Like in a pretty major way.
Yeah.
Like what you don't do to your superior officers.
And the general is just completely unfazed by it.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just like,
cares.
Oh, I see what you are. Like I had you figured the wrong way. Like I thought you were like me. You were playing this parlor game. You
yeah.
were kind of.
He says, you're an idealist.
Yeah, you're an idealist. And I pity you because, I mean, idealists don't.
Can you imagine
that line?
Not going to
make it in this world, you know?
Like you're an idealist and I pity you
yeah,
for that.
Yeah.
It's just like.
And the thing is,
all,
like,
man.
He's not necessarily wrong in the sense that the way the whole system is set up, that.
Yeah.
You are, you know, destined for failure and something bad.
If you don't play the game.
If you don't play the game. So
yeah,
they made a really interesting point on Friendly Fire about how you could actually argue, had Kirk Douglas taken the promotion, gone along with it,
mm-hmm.
he actually probably could have leaned on some of the generals and had more of an influence.
Actually, yeah, yeah.
And actually, like, maybe preserved some more people's lives,
right?
By being that voice, you know, he wouldn't necessarily have absolute command, or he would still get overruled at different points. But
he could have had influence. So
he could have
right.
had some influence to kind of like gently nudge them away
yeah.
from some of the more disastrous decisions.
Like, think about the lesson we learned at Ant Hill,
yeah,
guys.
Right,
like,
right.
Maybe we should try this approach instead of this approach.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he kind of like shoots himself in the foot, but.
It's like a little bit of you know, spitefulness or sort of arrogance or
idealism.
What's the word I'm looking for though?
The general's kind of right.
Pride, you know, it's
like
pride
your idealism
in a way.
Is gonna yeah. like yeah.
He's like,
get
I mean,
in your way.
I mean, the general is sort of has this you know, realpolitik, like this notion that. War is messy, war is hell.
Yeah.
Bad things happen to good people. And you just have to live with that reality and really see it for what it is
mm-hmm.
and not have your mind kind of filled with these abstract ideas of like justice and what's right. And
yeah.
you just got to look at what is material here and now. And, you know, your idealism is not going to save anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to do anybody any favors because it is this hollow gesture. And you just kind of blew up your career by dressing me down.
Yeah.
And I don't care. And it's not going to change my outlook on things. All you've done is, you know, like you said, shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah. It's almost like the attitude is like, well, I hope that keeps you warm at night.
Right. Yeah.
I'm out.
And it's like, you know, Kirk Douglas has like, he gets the last line in where he's like, if you can't see what's wrong with that, then I pity you.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
But it's very empty. It's very hollow. It's like,
no, as a viewer, you're not like, yeah.
Yeah.
You showed him.
I mean, he sat back down at that table and took another bite of his muffin and just like didn't worry about it, you know?
Took another bite of his muffin.
Yeah.
And then we get that great final scene, man. They go to the,
yes.
the whatever, the pub.
Yeah.
Or the show hall. And
yeah.
there's that the German woman is brought out who Kubrick later married.
Christiane Kubrick, yeah.
And like I said earlier, those cat calls and the whistling and the screaming are drowning her out. And I kept waiting for there was a tenseness in that scene to where I was sitting there, I thought one of those guys was gonna stand up and shoot her.
Yeah. Or something bad could have happened, you know, it could
or rape her.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like, I was just sitting there like,
yeah. like it could have gotten
heart in my
real,
throat.
Real ugly. Yeah.
yeah, but it didn't, it was not, again, expectation subverted.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not the scene that I thought was gonna happen.
No, it's a surprisingly like emotional
mm-hmm.
kind of touching moment, you know?
Yeah.
In a way.
The 1950s, like the way he shot it was interesting. Those cutaways.
It's very like almost
faces.
Documentary style. It reminds
yeah.
me of like a Frederick Wiseman or something where it's kind of these real close-ups of just human
yeah.
faces and they're not saying anything, but you're just reading the pure emotion in
mm-hmm.
this moment of these men's eyes welling up with tears as they sing
yeah.
along to the song. And you kind of realize like, For just a brief moment, she's kind of like melted the ice, you
yeah.
know, that she's broken down the barriers. And even though they can't understand because she's singing in German, they're
mm-hmm.
French. And they even say, like, why don't you sing in a civilized language?
Right.
But it's like she briefly, there's this like shared moment of humanity
mm-hmm.
where they all kind of remember what it was like maybe before the war and right. What they were like when they were younger before all this happened to them. And it's a very, very interesting scene. Again, it's one of those like I think it's Kubrick again, like editorializing or just having this like big moment, like here's my grand finale where I'm gonna like finally break the mold of like the cynicism and the kind of, although it does immediately lead to Kirk Douglas standing outside and the guy informing him, hey, these guys are going to go back on the front line.
Yeah.
And he just says, well, let them in, have a few more minutes and then, you know.
Yeah, which I feel like it was done a lot in films after this.
Yeah.
That war scene where the orders come in and some general, or not general, but some, you know, officer says like, we'll let him have this.
Yeah.
Let him have this night. We'll tell him tomorrow.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
So like even when they're experiencing that kind of that relief, that happiness, it's because they don't know that their death warrant has kind of already been signed and they're just not aware of it. It's like the kind of reminds me in a weird way of like the ending of Jacob's Ladder where you know, he has this moment of like transcendence. He walks up the stairs with his son. They've been reunited and it just kind of goes to all pure white.
Right.
And then it cuts to like the men on the operating table.
Right.
Just kind of like, well, call it, you know, it's 5 o'clock, you know, he's dead. Like just that sense of like, you've been delivered, you've been saved from all of this. And oh no, wait, actually you are dead. There's, you know, there is no salvation here.
Man, what a movie. I mean, this is one that I'm glad I'm seeing all these now because this and Barry Lyndon, like, I immediately, I'm like, well, I'm going to see those movies in two or three more times in my life.
Yeah.
Like, this is a movie I will revisit several more times.
Sure.
And look forward to it.
Yeah.
To make this film in 90 minutes, to make it in 1957 and say the things that he said, this early Kubrick, to see this auteur budding, you know, really, really interesting stuff.
The speed with which he kind of, because if you look at his very first film, which we will probably not do an episode on, I would imagine.
Which was what? Before The Killing?
Fear and Desire,
Yeah, I saw The Killing many, many years ago, like in college.
The Killing is his third film, actually. So he does Fear and Desire.
Okay.
He does Killer's Kiss, then The Killing.
I've seen Killer's Kiss and The Killing, actually.
Yeah. I think The Killing's pretty great.
No, and Killer's Kiss is good, too.
Yeah. But, you know, Fear and Desire is very, like, student film, very kind of, you know, Kubrick really did disown that film. And he even, like, went as far as to buy up all the copies,
really?
The prints that were in circulation. And
1953.
Didn't distribute it on any kind of video. Whenever there would be Kubrick retrospectives, it was not shown.
Oh, really?
It just kind of, like, it circulated for years as, like, a really bad kind of VHS bootleg. And then since Kubrick's death, it has actually been restored and you can buy, like, there's like a commercial Blu-ray of it now. But, you know, the quantum leap he makes between 53 and 57 is unbelievable how quickly he advances in terms of, you know, going from pretty humble beginnings to becoming like a world-class filmmaker by the time he makes this film. I mean, Kirk Douglas, you know, still to this day, I think, says that Paths of Glory is like the favorite film of his he ever made.
A lot of people in this movie said that.
Yeah.
Turkle says that.
Right.
And I think one other person.
Adolf Monjou, I think, also.
Yeah.
They, you know, Kirk Douglas has this statement, something to the effect of like, this was maybe 10 or 15 years after he had made Paths of Glory. He was like, that one is going to be an all-timer. That one is great. I don't have to wait 50 years to, you know, for the jury to be in on this one to see if it lives or if it dies. Like, I know that one in my bones, I can feel that one is just like an all-timer, a great film.
Right on the money.
Yeah.
You got anything else?
No, I think, I guess we're headed to Full Metal Jacket for the next one.
I think so. I mean, I'm looking around. I mean, we're going to go through all these, I think, at the end, maybe starting with Killer's Kiss.
Yeah.
I don't see the reason to go back for Fear and Desire.
No.
But then we'll see about Spartacus. But we definitely should do Lolita, Strangelove in 2001. 2001, that's the one that I need to see again because my dirty secret is I don't love that movie.
Uh-huh.
But I need to give it a good, like, critical watch.
Yeah, yeah.
Again.
That one, I love that film.
Yeah, all right. I need to get back into it.
And it's funny because for a number of years, I kind of thought the same as you. I was sort of like, I've seen it. I respect it. I understand why it was important and all that stuff. But just as a viewing experience, it's not like my favorite thing to sit down and look at.
Yeah,
that was my position for a long time.
Tough.
That's the thing, though, is I would say like the last two or three times I've seen it, and I've seen it, you know, multiple times recently because it had this theatrical re-release.
Right.
I was lucky to see it in 70 millimeter in Paris.
Oh wow.
And then it played here in Atlanta. On a digital print, but it was like a really nice 4K restoration. So I have seen it a number of times recently. And when I watch it now, it like even the fact that it has like an intermission, it's like, oh man, no intermission. Just like keep going. Like,
yeah.
It's not boring at all to me anymore is
all
what
right.
I'm saying. Is,
I need
is
to get
that,
back into it.
I completely just get immersed in that film and really, really enjoy it.
All right. So let's do Full Metal Jacket next.
Yeah.
I've already done a Clockwork Orange in here, which kind of
that's all right.
Kind of ruins that.
That's that used to be like one of my favorite Kubricks, and now it's maybe not so much.
Yeah.
So,
I'm all Barry Lyndon right now, man.
Yeah. No, I know. I think that would be the number one for me too.
All right, so we'll do Full Metal Jacket next, everyone. I'll have Casey back in here in the next month or so.
Yeah.
It's good to see you again.
Great. Yeah.
I mean,
great
I see you around the office, but
yeah, that's true.
It's always good to sit down like this.
Yeah.
All right, thanks everyone. Go check out Paths of Glory if you have not.
Yes.
Maybe you've saved this episode to watch that one beforehand. Highly recommend you watch these before Casey and I talk about them. All right, thanks, bud.
Yeah, thank you.
Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.